The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We're going to have two discussions here. In the first part of our program, we're going to be talking with Councilwoman Helen Holton, who represents the 8th District, about a bill she's introducing to call on the state, the city police commissioner, to update the council on the homicide investigation and the death of Ken Harris, former city councilman. We'll talk about that in just a minute. And then after that, we'll be talking with Charles Faddis, who is author of Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside of Rock. And Sam Faddis is a former CIA operative and agent working behind the lines in Iraq. The book was very illuminating and fascinating about more to learn about what happened in Iraq with the Kurds, with the Iraqis, with the Bush administration. And we'll get to that in a little bit. Stories you probably think to only exist in James Bond movies. Well, this is the real thing, and we'll talk about that in just a little minute with Charles Faddis. Right now, we welcome Helen Holton to the program. Helen, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here with you.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Fighting a little cold, but otherwise I'm here.
Well, I hope you get better.
Thank you.
Haven't talked to you since Denver, I think.
Probably so.
Join us here, folks, at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. Right now we're talking with City Councilwoman Helen Holton. So Helen, we've seen in the city, they said the murder rate has gone down, but so has the closing rate of homicide and resolving murders in the city.
Yeah.
I think there's 181 murders so far in the city of Baltimore this year.
Uh-huh.
I mean, one is too many, but 181. So talk a bit about why you think that this discussion, if murder rates are going down, has to take place now.
It has to take place now for several reasons, and I guess it should have taken place a long time ago. And I think there are several points of convergence for me. Number one, it's one thing when you, one murder, any murder is too many murders, but to look at how the clearance rate is down, and the piece of how families, the real victims beyond the murdered victim, how they fare in all of this. And I think being up close and personal with a former council member's death and just a sense of, a feeling of no sense of urgency, I said, my goodness, what about the families that are not the survivors of a known public figure?
Mm-hmm.
What are they getting? How are they getting closure? What does justice look like for them?
Well, but what do you think, if the homicide rate is dropping, but the more important thing, if the closure
the clearance rate
is so low, 45%, I think, and it was used to be in the 80 percentile range.
That's right.
Before in Baltimore.
Right.
So the question is, what's happening? I mean, people are pointing fingers at the community, saying nobody is willing to come forth when it comes to crimes of violence. People are pointing fingers at the state's attorney's office, saying that you're not allowing us to make the cases to arrest these people. And they're saying, no, the police are not making the case, so we can arrest people and prosecute. And everybody's pointing fingers at everyone else. There's not enough community involvement, but the city doesn't invest in community involvement. But nobody seems to be forcing anyone to sit down to have a conversation about what works.
Let me put it in this context. We go through life completing tasks, whatever that may be. And sometimes we get more focused on the task than how the task gets accomplished. And tasks get accomplished through our relationships with people. And I think we have a breakdown in communication. You know, the number one reason that, the number one complaint I hear from constituents with the police is disrespect. And so if police officers aren't giving people a sense of value or the feeling that they're respected as individuals when they don't need them, what do you think happens when there's a time when they need them?
But I guess my question, though, is, I mean, again, it's just laying it all at the doorstep of the police. It seems to me that there's a universal problem going here between the police,
and the public.
And the public and the city government and the state attorney's office and the police department, that someone in the city needs to pull people together to be on
one accord.
Yes.
Well, and you're absolutely right, but I think it begins with relationships and how we relate to one another. The commissioner who came to the council lunch yesterday said, you know, neighbors aren't talking to each other. It's as simple as a hello to begin. But I think gone are the days where officers walk the streets.
But
where
I thought
they
that was
got to know the faces on in a neighborhood.
But didn't Commissioner Bielenson say that when he came into office...
Adopt the block.
Right.
Let's get the officers out of the car and adopt the block.
Are you saying that hasn't happened yet?
Well, I can speak for my district. But I've been working with my major in my district, and, you know, we started with district-wide citizens on patrol, and we're looking to move into the adopt-the-block format with a couple of our neighborhoods. The challenge is the police department's understaffed. The challenge is, and I don't say that as an excuse, the challenge is we're understaffed. And so we've got to find creative ways to think out of the box to get accomplished what our needs are without compromising crime-fighting activities. I think that the notion of... I love the Neighborhood Services Unit, where you have officers that get out to know the people in the neighborhood, but I think it has to be the officers that are doing the arrest, that are tracking crime, that they've got to get to know not just the people who come to community associations, because by and large, you take any community, you're getting a fraction of the people that live in that community showing up to the meetings regularly, but the officer needs to walk the streets of those neighborhoods.
Well, I guess what I'm fishing for here in a more direct way is, I mean, you're introducing this resolution.
I need to know what is the process by which we're addressing our homicides. The commissioner said himself in the paper on Sunday that he went to a community meeting angry and frustrated because there had only been two phone calls from the community that had come in regarding Ken Harris's death. Now, there's been an outpouring of hundreds of people from the vigil at the Haven, to the viewing at Huber Memorial, to the funeral that was so large, it packed the Fine Arts, Morgan Fine Arts. The Carl Murphy Center. So you have this outpouring of people that are grieved over this loss. Somebody knows something. The commissioner said in the paper, these are local people. They live in the neighborhood. They didn't jump in a car and drive away. They didn't get on a helicopter and go to Pennsylvania. They ran on foot.
But what about the other part of the problem is that because of lack of resources, because of the lack of money in the city, maybe that's part of the root cause of the problem, that people are afraid to step up. People are afraid to say, oh, I saw this person do it, because who's going to protect them?
Well, let's look at this. I talked about a sense of urgency. And I know that each day you get away from the incident, the less likely you are to find answers to get people willing to step up. Let's look at Metro Crime Stoppers. You know, Councilman D'Adamo talked about it on the floor Monday night. $2,000 is what Metro Crime Stoppers puts up. Now, I've put up money. Senator Conway's put up money. You know, others have put up money, but who knows if that's something that can be done, and that's something that should have been done immediately. And I'm not saying that we should have to pay for the information, but I think you have to incentivize people sometimes to get involved and step up.
We're talking with Councilwoman Helen Holt right now, who is introducing a resolution to the city council tonight, correct?
No, it was last night.
Last night. Calling for the city police commission to update the council on the homicide investigation of former city council person Ken Harris, who was gunned down in Northwood Shopping Center. And remember, we did several shows about that, and we were there at the shopping center as I emceed the evening to remember him in the vigil. And no one has stepped forward. And let's see what you think before we take a break at 410-319-8888. What does the city do about homicides, about people being afraid in communities, about people not talking to the police? What do the police do about solving these murders and violent crimes in our midst? And Dana in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Dana.
Hello, Councilwoman Holton. This is Dana.
How are you?
And I'm fine. And I'm supportive of everything you're saying. And I just wanted to know if you thought offering a reward would help bring about those who were involved in Ken Harris's murder.
What I can say is this. and it's not offering a reward, whatever, but having money available for information. And I'm speaking historically. In the past, it has been a viable means to get people to step up to tell what they know.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes more than just offering money for a reward, and it goes back to relationship. In this time, and I'm not going to put a lot of credibility into the stop snitching piece, because I think that when officers get to know people in a community during peaceful times, when there's not a need to say we're looking for information, you don't know where that information comes from.
Mm-hmm.
In hard economic times that we're in right now, you have somebody, there are people in this town who know the people who did this, that if they said, well, gee, I need to pay my gas and electric bill, if I can call up and give them information that's a valid lead, hey, that might be worth a couple $1,000s.
But how does that, Councilman Holton, how does that work if you're talking about all the other murders in the city, all the other violent crimes?
Oh, well, my point is there should be that should be available. Metro Crime Stoppers is available for any murder.
But I know some people, like Nick D'Adamo, councilperson, saying you should raise it to $20,000. I think that's what he said.
Yeah, but I don't know if it should be $20,000 across the board for every opportunity.
Well, I mean, but would it be better spent if we put money into programs that made the neighborhood safer in some other ways, in terms of having workers in the neighborhood to work door-to-door with kids and families with some money to make sure that people who want to step up if someone has committed a violent crime are protected by the police, by the community, from the thugs who would kill them? And why are we not thinking about those kinds of things? I mean, that's what we have to do. People are frightened to step up to tell.
But you know what, Mark? It's a both and. It's not an either or.
But we don't have money for both and anymore.
Well, you know what? And that's why Metro Crime Stoppers, they give seed money, $2,000. It doesn't mean that if that family that is grieving the loss of a loved one says, hey, you know what, you want to help, give $50, give $100 to Metro Crime Stoppers. That's out of individuals. And the case I'm going to use, look at the campaign of Barack Obama. More money raised in the history of presidential elections. The average contribution, $87. And so it's possible, but you have to wake up the people. I think we're living in times where people have become numb to violence and murder.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is what I like to offer. And then we can do this. The election is a week from today.
Yes.
We will know who the next president of the United States of America will be. And we'll have a week's worth of programs coming up looking at this election, because, I mean, it's probably the most critical election, in my lifetime, I think.
Mine as well.
Yes. And I think that right after that, you know, we have a beautiful auditorium down here in the first floor of this building. We should have a meeting with the community. You can be present. Bring the mayor, police commissioner, and let's discuss what it is we need to do to help resolve this issue in this community.
I agree, and I'm going to say this. I think we need to not just say what the problem is, but address
solutions
to the problem.
No, we all know the problem is.
And one of the things I've always been an advocate of, either you pay on the front end or you pay a whole lot more on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
And from after-school programming, but it's not just about the kids who are going to come to the after-school programming. There's a whole culture out here that no one's talking to, that no one's reaching out to. And that's the constituency that we've got to infiltrate and penetrate and give them opportunities for hope, opportunities for a future.
We will be back in touch, and we'll put this together and come back to the airwaves with this very soon.
Very good.
Always good to talk to you. Thank you so much for all you do.
Thank you.
Councilwoman Helen Holton, we will come back to that once we find out who the next president of the United States of America is. But first, we're going to come back in just a minute and meet our second guest of the hour. For the rest of the hour, Charles Faddis, known as Sam Faddis, is author of Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. He was a CIA operative for over 20 years, and we'll talk about his inside Iraq operations before the Iraq War started and the Bush administration and more. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We have a very interesting conversation will take place right now. I actually met the author of this book by happenstance at breakfast one morning, sitting not far from one another. We introduced ourselves to one another, and it turned out we knew his publicist both, and it was a very small world we ran into. But Charles Faddis, Sam, I can call you, right? Sam Faddis is a former CIA agent for 20 years, and Sam Faddis worked in. Let me make sure, is your microphone working here? Speaking to that for a minute, see if you got.
I think it's working.
We got you. We're good. So Sam Faddis was a former CIA agent who worked in a clandestine group, an operations group inside of Iraq before the American troops went to Iraq to take out Al Qaeda, to take out the enemies of the United States of America as a counterterrorism agent with a group of other men. We'll talk about that, the relationship with this present administration, the Bush administration, what happened with them, and more. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Charles Faddis, the book Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. And Sam, good to have you on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, let's define some terms here. I mean, you know, as I think you and Mike Tucker, who you wrote the book with, say in the beginning of the book, you know, there's the Bourne stories and James Bond, and we hear about counterterrorism agents and all glorified with champagne and fancy women. But
right. I never found any of those operations, but I've heard about it.
But let's talk a bit about what that, before we jump into the story about that world. I mean, what does it mean to be a counterterrorism agent for the Central Intelligence Agency? Because just to be sort of, what does that mean? What is that?
Well, first, the CIA doesn't use that term. When they refer to agent, they mean somebody who's generally a foreign national who's providing information to the United States government. But CIA agent is what the popular expression is. What the CIA calls that is an operations officer. That's the guy or the gal who recruits spies, finds terrorists, engages in covert action when that's called for. In other words, capturing people, or in some cases, involved in operations that result in people being killed. And in my case, I operated in Europe, South Asia, the Middle East, throughout that region, working mostly terrorism or weapons of mass destruction cases, things like that.
So the CIA is an interesting place. I mean, I always, in the years of interviewing different people who have been involved in intelligence work, I always found that they have a very broad spectrum of cultural and political belief and understanding that goes in. We have this kind of, I think, stereotypical view of people who work for the CIA as all kind of right-wing fascists who would overthrow the American government if certain people got elected.
Right. I love MASH, but Colonel Flagg is not necessarily a good pattern for. I think that's a great question because that's absolutely true. I think the general image that's projected of what people who are doing operational work for the CIA are like politically and attitude wise is pretty far of the mark. I mean, frankly, I think what you find is that when you have men and women who spend their life overseas and really know cultures and interact mostly with foreigners, that they tend to be much more attuned to the way people overseas think. And frequently their response when somebody from the White House or elsewhere in the administration comes up with a brilliant plan to do something, typically the response from the agency is often, it doesn't sound like such a brilliant plan to us, and maybe we ought to rethink that. Which, and that conversation typically terminates with, you know, when we want you to have an opinion, we'll give it to you. Now go and do what we told you to do. But
so the question, again, before we jump into the heart of the book, is that here you are, and probably not unlike many other men and women who applied your trade for the years you did, 20 years, you speak or have knowledge of at least four languages. I think we talked about them earlier in the green room. Greek, Turkish, Kurdish, Arabic.
Correct.
You have a law degree from the University of Maryland.
Correct.
And from what I've read about you, a pretty cultured guy, likes knows Dante, likes reading the classics, understands history. So what is it that motivates and gets people 20 years ago when you must have been in your 20s or 30s, whatever that was, to join the CIA and become an operations officer of the CIA? What was the motivation to do that? I mean, and the motivation of the men and women around you, do you think?
Usually what I tell people when they ask me that question is that it was a calling. And that's kind of an old-fashioned expression that you don't hear a lot anymore. Mm-hmm. But one of those things that you just find yourself drawn to. And if I had to dissect it beyond that, I mean, it was in large measure a desire to serve the country and do things that I thought were important. But also mixed in there are healthy doses of just wanderlust and looking for, you know, looking for adventure, for lack of a better term, not to make it sound silly. But I think all of that sort of gets balled up together, and that was certainly my case. I was working as a prosecuting attorney out in Washington State. I was out of the Army. I had a great job and a great house, and all I thought was, there's no way I'm driving the same 12-minute commute to and from work for the rest of my life. I gotta go do something else.
So instead you decided to go into a job that drops you behind Iraqi enemy lines in Kurdistan to hunt down Al-Qaeda.
Maybe there's a dose of stupidity in there as well.
Charles Faddis is our guest, F-A-D-D-I-S. The book we're talking about is Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. And Sam Faddis went into Iraq and Kurdistan before the official invasion by the United States of America took place in Iraq to hunt down Al-Qaeda terrorists. We're going to talk about that. Join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in on this conversation with any questions you may have or comments, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So we talk with Sam Faddis, Charles Faddis, Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. So here you are, given an assignment to go into Iraq to literally hunt down, working with Kurdish Peshmerga, which you can describe to us who they are, the Kurdish Peshmerga, to hunt down Al-Qaeda and the terrorists who had some involvement or their organization involvement in blowing up and attacking America on 9/11.
Right. When we went in, when we finally went in country, because we had been trying to get in country since spring of 2002.
Trying to get in country? You describe that in the book, so just talk
right.
What you mean.
Right. I was named as the leader of the team, the first team that would go into Iraq in advance of the invasion of Iraq in February 2002. So, and as of the time I was named as team leader, that's probably not an accurate description because I more or less demanded to be named team leader. I volunteered for the assignment. We anticipated at that point that we were going to actually be on the ground inside Iraq as of March of 2002. And as is detailed extensively in the book, the missing piece in the administration's plan here, at least one of them, was that they had never gotten the Turks on board with this entire effort.
That was pretty shocking to read that in your book.
Right. And in fact, when I was briefed on the assignment, the first question I asked was, what do the Turks say about this? Because anybody who understands the region knows that you're not going to do any of the things that were intended without having the approval of the Turkish government.
And you speak Turkish, you understand Turkish culture, you understand Turkish politics.
Right.
That was part of the work you did for the CIA for many years. That's why you know Turkish.
Exactly. And that's why I knew when I told them I want this job that they would give me the job, because I had that background and I had that experience. So that was the first question I asked. I shouldn't claim any special knowledge. There were lots of other people that were familiar with the region who were asking exactly the same question. Haven't we skipped a step? We can't do anything unless we have the Turkish government on board. That was more or less dismissed by the administration, and we just sort of trundled past that with obviously dire consequences. So,
excuse me, when you talk about the administration, I mean, the CIA, you're working with the CIA, but the White House, this is a White House operation. They knew what you were doing. This was part of a plan to go after terrorists inside of Iraq.
When we originally stood up the team in early 2002, February 2002, meaning we're now pulling together guys, pulling together equipment, we're training, we're getting ready to go. Number one mission on the number one item on our list of missions on our operational tasks is begin preparation for the invasion of Iraq. So that's the first critical thing that I think people should understand here is You know, in February 2002, when we stood up this team, we stood up this team because the decision had been made, we are going to invade Iraq.
So everything else that we, as I read this part of your book, it was like everything we went through with the UN, all the back and forth, the machinations, the Bush administration was poppycock. You were sent over there in advance of an invasion. They already knew was going to take place.
Apparently so. The extent to which this is true is really kind of hard to imagine, actually. But in fact, when we stood up the team and we were, say, March, April, we hoped to be on the ground inside Iraq, we were originally being briefed that this whole thing would be over in about 60 days. In other words, we should only plan on being in country for 60 days, which is where the moniker of Hotel California comes from. This is something that the team themselves christened themselves because you sort of – yeah, you sent us here for 60 days, but apparently
we'll never get out.
We're never getting out. You can check out anytime you want, but mm-hmm. you can never leave. I can remember vividly being inside Iraq much later when this whole diplomatic initiative was launched and we went to the United Nations and talking people to headquarters and saying, I'm sorry, I don't understand what's going on. You sent me here months and months and months ago telling me the decision had been made, but now we're at the United Nations acting like we haven't made the decision, and the response was, don't worry about it. Nothing's changed. We're still going. So, but in any event, the invasion was always the number one mission. By the time we actually got in the summer of 2002, we had acquired intelligence that we had al-Qaeda in large numbers fleeing across Iran from Afghanistan, running away from U.S. forces, and taking refuge in an enclave in the northern part of Iraq, which is controlled by basically a Taliban-like organization called Ansar al-Islam, a lawless region, not under the control of Saddam Hussein and not under the control of friendly Kurds.
Now, Ansar al-Islam was a Kurdish fundamentalist group, correct? Or predominantly Kurdish?
It was predominantly Kurdish, more or less on a parallel to the Taliban in terms of their beliefs and their attitudes. And when the al-Qaeda fighters, al-Qaeda had a pre-existing relationship with Ansar, very minimal but pre-existing. So they were essentially using this enclave as a lifeboat, if you will, a place to reconstitute, rebuild, and regenerate. And we had detected that. The Kurds, friendly Kurdish forces, had told us that. We went in-country working with both the KDP and the PUK.
And they are?
The KDP and the PUK were the two independent Kurdish political entities that existed in northern Iraq. So if you look on a map, technically within the confines of the international borders of Iraq, but it had been many years since Saddam had had any control over them. They were, in fact, as people will recall, protected by the no-fly zone. They were, in effect, independent countries. We went in, worked with these guys, targeted al-Qaeda, who were working with Ansar, and what we found actually was that the Kurds, we went in with the idea that probably the Kurds were exaggerating the extent of the al-Qaeda presence, because that would be typical. What we found is they were actually underestimating the size of the al-Qaeda presence, and we found a couple of hundred al-Qaeda fighters there.
So this is what really is mind-boggling as I read your book, and I really enjoyed it, because I think the book is – I mean, it's really kind of inside a covert operation and get a sense of what really goes on in a covert operation without the romantic silliness of what happens and embedding yourself among Kurdish fighters in Kurdistan. And we'll talk about why you went into Iraq and the rest. But you were there to kind of literally take out, as best you could, take out the al-Qaeda leadership and al-Qaeda. Now, most of the news is telling us al-Qaeda fled to Pakistan. But you're saying this huge body of al-Qaeda, American government knew, because you knew, that they went east from Afghanistan, across Iran and into Iraq.
That's correct.
That early in this, even before we invaded Iraq with our American troops.
Right. Now, certainly large numbers of al-Qaeda went into Pakistan, both into the settled areas and into the tribal areas, as everybody is aware. A large number of them also went the other direction and fled across Iran. They had established routes for crossing Iran for a long time. They ended up in this region. We located them. We worked with the Kurds. We ran agents. We acquired intelligence in a whole variety of ways. We essentially mapped every one of their locations, every one of their facilities down to exact coordinates. And then we put together a plan which we sent to Washington to go in and eliminate them all.
And Well, should we take a break here? We're talking about eliminate them all now. It's time to take a break. We'll come back and learn what eliminating them all means in taking out Al-Qaeda in Iraq, why they did or didn't, how they did, what happened between that time and the time the American forces invaded Iraq, a little less than a year later. So join us here at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Sam Faddis, Charles Faddis, who wrote the book Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside of Iraq. Stay with us. Sitting here with Charles Faddis, who wrote the book, along with Mike Tucker, Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. This is a book about his work as a counter-terrorist, working for the CIA, going behind enemy lines in Iraq before the United States forces went into Iraq. They were scheduled there a year before to take out Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda who was there before the American forces invaded. Not as the guests of Saddam Hussein necessarily, but as guests of their brothers, terrorists who were Iraqis and Kurds. And they were there to take them out. So we're talking about what that meant, but also about the relationship with the U.S. government, what it says about American policy, and what life is like for somebody who works for the CIA. And if you hear me call Charles Faddis Sam, it's because he goes by Sam, but his name is Charles Faddis, F-A-D-D-I-S. You can Google that now and take a look at what he's been saying as we have this conversation here. Join us here at 410-319-8888 if you'd like to ask any question you'd like of Sam Faddis, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So, Sam, we left off. I know that you had a hard time. We talked earlier about getting from Turkey into Iraq. They didn't want you to stage your entering Kurdistan from there.
Correct.
There's an ongoing war and hatred between the Turks and the Kurds over Kurdish desire to be independent, an independent nation.
Absolutely.
Which goes back to World War One, but we don't have to go back there. We have time. It's a lot of history there. But let's talk a bit about this. So here you are with the Peshmerga, the Kurdish army, the Kurdish guerrillas forces, who, with you, as you stated before we went on break, found this huge Al-Qaeda presence. And you write in the book that they may have had, and they had chemical labs, biological warfare labs, that they could have used against the Kurds and anybody else on the planet. And your job was to just go in there, literally, to take them out. I mean, you were going in there to kill Al-Qaeda.
Absolutely. Our job was to go find them, fix them, and then obviously they've just attacked the United States. They've killed 3,000 of our citizens. Our job is to get rid of them before they can complete their job of reconstituting. I mean, we used to joke on the team that this is kind of like one of those old Godzilla movies where you blow up the monster and then each piece starts growing into a new monster, because as fast as these guys had arrived in the Kurdish areas with Ansar, they immediately began to replicate exactly what they've been doing in Afghanistan. So by the time we got there, they had a functioning chemical and biological warfare facility going. Now, obviously pretty crude, but they were working hard at perfecting it.
Now, but you say in the book you were so close to them you could see the colors of the kafir, the Arabic headdresses they were wearing. They were that close to their camp. So tell us what happened. I mean, were you allowed to go in and then take them out? Were you allowed to stop them? Talk about the politics and the reality on the ground with you and the Kurds and the CIA and the White House and what actually happened there, if you could.
Right. Well, when we were done acquiring what we considered to be sufficient information to take out this enclave, and frankly, I would say based on my experience, really exceptionally detailed information. I mean, the way we describe it in the book is we had 10-digit grid coordinates in all their locations, being a military reference, and that's about as exact a map reference as you can get. I mean, a 10-digit grid means literally you can drop a precision bomb and it's going to land directly on the guy's head, in effect, for all intents and purposes. So we had them completely mapped. We then proceeded to begin a series of discussions with Washington about how we were going to take these guys out. We were working with Peshmerga. At this point, we were working with Peshmerga from the PUK, which is the entity that the Kurdish political entity that controlled that area. They had a number of guys under arms. They were also relatively short on ammunition. They were also worried about the fact that they might have to go to war with Saddam. So they weren't necessarily all that excited about taking on Ansar all by themselves and going in and cleaning out this compound. So we started by asking for U.S. ground troops. Somebody. We're not picky, but we need some augmentation here in terms of U.S. boots on the ground to carry this out. The response from Washington was, that's not going to happen. So then we moved on to, okay, you know what? The eight of us and the Peshmerga will do it by ourselves, but we could use some air support. The response from Washington was, well, after much deliberation, well, that's not going to happen either. So finally we said, look, you know, the Kurds have a bunch of these 120-millimeter old Russian mortars. They don't have much ammunition for them. You give us ammunition for the mortars, which we can use to take out strong points and so forth, and that's all we need. We'll give us the ammunition, and the Kurds and the eight of us will take care of it anyway. That request as well was turned down. Before we left, actually, to push the issue to the nth degree, we actually wrote out a detailed operational proposal for the entire thing and sent it anyway back to Washington saying, here's the entire plan and how we will do it and how we will get rid of these guys because they don't know we're here. We have them in our sights. They're hard at work on all sorts of planning and activity, and now is the time to get rid of them. All of those proposals were turned down. That enclave was finally attacked spring of 2003 by U.S. Special Forces. And they did a great – I mean, they did the best job they could under the circumstances. They're great guys. But there was so much lead up to that attack and so much warning that it was coming that when they attacked, every target of significance had walked across the border into Iran. And many of those guys that got away then walked back across the border subsequently and were – big participants in the insurgency against our troops.
Who put in the IUDs and the bombs that killed American soldiers.
Absolutely. In fact,
and Iraqi people.
We are, I've been out of the agency now for 4 months, but we were still hunting down some of them as of the day I left.
So it's unfathomable to me that well, first of all, that I'm no longer shocked that lies come out of the Bush White House about what they do and don't do. That's not no longer a shock. But what is a shock is that they send forces in there to take care of Al-Qaeda, who had attacked the United States of America, who, whether you agree or don't agree with the Iraq war and the invasion of Iraq, you were sent there to clear out Al-Qaeda before the invasion took place, and then were not allowed to do the job.
Absolutely a shock, and as you can well imagine, it was not a message that was well received on the team. I mean, we were...
What was this behavior you expected from Washington from your past work as a clandestine operative for the CIA, or is this something that was relatively new in terms of the behavior of Washington towards the kind of operations you and your men and women would do?
Well, I think when you work for the CIA, you accept as part of the job that there are going to be any number of occasions when you're downrange and you get a message from Washington with which you don't agree. And just like being in the United States Army, at some point you salute. But I have to say that the scope of this and the nature of the topics that are under discussion was something that I've never experienced before. I've been asked by any number of people when I talk to them about the fact that this decision was made and we were not given permission to go ahead. The next question is, well, why? Why could they possibly make this decision? Part of it was clearly that the invasion of Iraq had already taken precedence over everything else. And somehow or another back home, they had decided that if we took action against Al-Qaeda, it would in some way or another trigger some sort of series of events that might complicate the invasion. So therefore, killing the guys who were part of an organization with which we were at war and which had already killed our citizens was now already taking a back seat to starting this war with Saddam Hussein.
And this is not to get political about it,
right?
Completely, but this is part of the argument taking place in the election right now, where Barack Obama and others are raising the issue: is our job to fight Al-Qaeda and take them on, or are we fighting a war in Iraq? Why are we not taking on I mean, it to stop Al-Qaeda's growth will take more than guns and war. It's going to take a whole different policy towards the Islamic world and the world in general.
I agree completely.
But you also have something hot going on, and you've got to deal with it at some level.
I agree. I mean, this war, if you want to use that phrase, and I think in some ways it's a good phrase and in some ways it's very negative because it conjures up images that aren't useful, is clearly a conflict that's going to have to be dealt with on a lot of levels beyond military and intelligence. It is a social, political, economic issue. So we need a much broader strategy. But that said, there really are some very bad people out there who are already at war with us and who we're not going to talk out of anything, and we do have to get rid of them. And here are a couple of hundred guys that we had in our sights. The other issue that I think is important, you talk about the election and, you know, where we go from here kind of thing. Part of the reason also that we had difficulty, I believe, in getting action taken in northern Iraq is the same reason that CIA, Gary Burnson, Delta ran into problems at Tora Bora with Al-Qaeda and getting action against bin Laden, which was that it proved impossible to get this whole national security apparatus to take any kind of actual quick, decisive action. We didn't need 10,000 guys in a 6-month planning cycle and endless discussions. We needed a decision in about 48 hours and very, very limited amount of force to take care of this. We couldn't get it. And that's exactly what happened at Tora Bora. Bin Laden walked away while somebody was still preparing PowerPoint presentations at the Pentagon on what to do.
So what do you do about that? I mean, what do you do about – I mean, we can argue back and forth about – and this is not the purpose of the show today, but you can argue back and forth about intelligence work and people can oppose what America did in Chile and in Guatemala in 54 and all that kind of stuff. And that's a legitimate argument that we should have about what our intelligence forces should be in subverting democratic institutions in Chile and Guatemala, which to me are just as abhorrent as letting terrorists get out of our sights. But what changes a intelligence network, an operation in the United States of America, to allow for the quick operations? I mean, if this is cumbersome as you're saying it is, whether Obama's president or McCain's president, how are they going to make this happen? How are they going to be allowed to conduct the war against those who have declared war on us?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think what you're talking about now is intelligence reform, but I think what you're talking about is real intelligence reform. And by that, I mean post 9/11, there have been all sorts of changes in the intelligence community in Washington, D.C. And effectively, every one of those changes has resulted in the creation of a new gigantic bureaucracy in Washington. So somehow, if we're not collecting the right information downrange or getting what we need, if we give 1,500 more guys in a new building computers and cubicles here in Washington, that's going to give us the information. It's kind of easy to do. You can build a building. We throw tax dollars around all the time. At the end of the day, it doesn't help. It probably hinders everything. It makes the bureaucracy bigger and more cumbersome. You're talking about having to go back to really the foundation of the thing. In my opinion, frankly, I think you may be talking about building a new organization. And I would not suggest building another organization to layer on top of the existing one. I mean, actually starting over.
We're talking with Charles Faddis, co-author of the book Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside of Iraq, his work inside Iraq before the war started with Iraq. As a CIA operations officer, 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Leslie in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi, Leslie.
How are you, brother?
Well.
You sound real somber tonight.
Me?
Yeah.
What's well, a serious conversation?
Yeah, very serious, very serious. But I have a question for you, guest, man.
Sure.
Sir, did I hear you correctly to say that you had only been out of the CIA for 4 months?
That is correct.
Okay. Man, thank God this is not a Robert Ludlum novel. But anyway, I don't understand how in only 4 months of being out of the CIA, that an individual would feel at liberty to talk about things that really is, I mean, not to say that what the CIA do is good or bad one way or the other, but my point is integrity point of view, man. I mean, it seemed like that you would be required. I mean, how can you? That's like to say you didn't have no knowledge of the nature of working in international intelligence and how they go about gathering it and the things that they do in the process. I mean, you went into a life like that voluntarily, I'm sure. And then for you to only be out for 4 months, man, and talk about this, it's like people like you can't be trusted in no sense of the way, not even in the sense that you're telling me something that's like a revelation.
You're not even highly trusted in. Let me let Sam respond. I mean, it's a fair question.
Absolutely, it's a fair question. The Central Intelligence Agency has a very formal mechanism for the review of all public materials that serving or former officers want to publish. And the entire manuscript for the book, everything we've talked about here, was put before the board, and everything that's in the book and everything we're talking about was cleared by the CIA. Everything they asked to be redacted was removed. I will say Mike Tucker is a former Marine infantryman himself. I was in the CIA and the United States Army, so actually the amount of material the agency had to remove was very limited because we were very careful when we wrote the book not to cross the lines that we knew shouldn't be crossed.
What does crossing the line mean? I mean, I know you can't tell me what the facts are, but what does it mean, crossing the line?
What they're really looking for is information that is going to compromise what they would call sources and methods. I mean, the clearest example would be naming the identity of somebody who's working for us clandestinely. By methods, they mean going into sufficient detail that it's going to compromise, it's going to allow somebody who's hostile to our interests to figure out how we do things.
Why would it be acceptable to them to allow a book like this to come out that, in many ways, if you read the book, is very damaging to the Bush administration, to Ambassador Khalilzad, who was the ambassador to Iraq, and you kind of really, his integrity is on the floor when you finish a couple paragraphs of him in this book. George Tenet, the former head of the CIA, doesn't come out looking real well at all when you talk about why he wouldn't talk about these clandestine groups, and even put it in his report about who you guys were and what your mission was and what you did. So why would they allow that kind of stuff to be put in this book?
Well, there have been a number of officers who've come out and written books about the agency, and each one of them, I think, has had their own experience with this review process. And I can't – Valerie Plame would be an example.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak for their experience. I can tell you what my experience was. My experience was that the review board functioned more or less the way it was supposed to function. In other words, it was an independent bureaucratic entity – and generally not really subject to a lot of political influence. And they went through and really were very, very selective and very careful in the things they asked us to remove. And obviously the things that are most explosive politically, since they don't have anything to do with sources and methods or actual compromising of operations, they didn't make any attempt to cause any problem with them at all. So my experience was that they performed as billed.
Let's talk about it before we go back to the phones here. Donald, hold on. We're going to come to your call in just a second at 410-319-8888 or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com as we talk with Charles Faddis about his book, Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside of Iraq, Inside Iraq. So towards the end of this tour you had in Iraq and Kurdistan, you actually did go from the border of Iraq Kurdistan into Iraq.
Correct.
And the Kurds were terrified about the missiles that might be fired at them, but the Americans didn't want to take them out. They were afraid to take them out. And also you had some confrontations with the Iraqi secret police in this process. Talk a bit about
Correct.
That and what led to the end of your stay there, if you would.
Well, we got to the point as our deployment developed, I guess the best way to characterize this is we were kicking up a lot of dust. We were moving very fast. We went in on the ground. We had a lot of ground to cover. And by that, I mean we went in and stood up an operation from nothing. So, and obviously, as I indicated before, we didn't have any idea what the timeline was. In fact, we thought we had a lot less time than we did. When you move that fast and you're trying to develop sources that quickly and you're not cutting corners, but you're still doing a lot of activity in a short schedule, you know, in a place like Northern Iraq where there are a lot of Iraqi agents, where Iraqi intelligence is very active, that your presence is not going to be a secret for very long. So we went through a period of time where the Iraqi Muhabarat, the Iraqi intelligence service, spent a lot of time trying to kill us, running sources against us, trying to lure us into ambushes. We went through a whole succession of instances where in all of those cases, we were capable because we had the necessary information of identifying those threats and capturing all of them before they could do anything to us and taking them away. When the conventional war started, we really began to run teams across the border, Kurdish teams, both to conduct sabotage against the Iraqis, but also basically to put eyes on targets behind Iraqi lines. These were teams that we trained and stood up and bring in airstrikes on targets. Those included conventional military targets. Those included surface-to-surface missiles. But a lot of that effort we directed at the Fedayeen and the Muhabarat, and these, especially after U.S. troops came into southern Iraq. At that point, when the Fedayeen, if you recall, was causing a lot of American casualties, and sort of, we really dedicated a lot of our resources to finding them, and we could do that because we had eyes on the ground where they were, and they would find wherever their headquarters was, and then we would blow that up, and then they would move to another location, and we would find that again, and we would blow that up.
So, we out of time? No, we have time. I'm sorry. I misread my guidelines here on the screen. My fault. We're talking with Charles Faddis. The book is Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq. 410-319-8888. And Donald, on your cell, you're on the air.
Yes, hello there, gentlemen.
Hi, Donald.
My two-part question. One is, why is it that America always has to have a bad guy to go after when Saddam Hussein, his country, was the most stablest part in the Middle East, on paper anyway? And then we have bin Laden in our sights, and I think you answered it earlier, where the administration, or as we used to call it, civilians, would change their mind after you would have him, you go on after him, then they say, let him go. Why is that, or can you answer that one for me?
Interesting question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Donald, for holding on.
I'm not sure why we always have to have a bad guy. I will say this. This is my personal opinion, obviously, nothing more. Whether we should have gone to war in Iraq, not gone to war in Iraq. I mean, Saddam Hussein was a monster. He was the world is a better place having gotten rid of him. I don't say that to end the debate about whether we should have gone in or whether we shouldn't have gone in. But the suffering that he inflicted on his own people and on the Kurds is just monstrous. There are mass graves throughout Kurdistan still of thousands and thousands of bodies. And pretty much every Kurd I ever worked with in Kurdistan had either been him or herself subjected to chemical attack, or had watched members of their families die in chemical attacks. I mean, this guy was a creature. In regard to letting bin Laden or walk away, I said this earlier, but I really do think that a part of this issue is the cumbersome nature, the overly bureaucratic nature of the structure that we're trying to fight this war with. And I continue to beat that drum because I think that's something we're going to leave Iraq one way or the other in the relatively near future, whatever that means. But I presume Barack Obama is going to be elected president. Regardless of who's elected president, we are going to leave. We are still going to be at war with al-Qaeda and other groups, and we have to figure out how to get this right. And we can't keep thinking that if somebody tells us that bin Laden is at such and such a location that we have 90 days to prepare a planning package. We need to get to the point where we have people organizationally that are nimble enough to do this. And I say organizationally because this is not a question of the guys on the ground. I mean, if somebody tells Delta Force to move, they're going to be moving before they finish giving the order. They will go anywhere. And that's true of basically anybody in the United States military. This is a bureaucracy question.
We have just a few minutes left at 410-319-8888. Shirley, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi, Shirley. You're on the air.
Hi. I just want to say to the author that I really appreciate the fact that he has put something in print that most of us already knew was fact anyway. If we go back to what Tenet did to the Secretary of State, I'm nervous.
It's all right.
The Secretary of State who just went for
Colin Powell.
Colin Powell at the UN.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of us appreciate the fact that this was going on long before then. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you, Shirley, for calling in. I wonder, and we only have about a minute and a half left here, if you talk about the chemical weapons, biological weapons that Al-Qaeda had their hands on. What do you think is going on from your own assessment very quick, in about a minute and a half here, 1 minute actually, why we have not been attacked again then?
Well, one factor that I think people need to appreciate is that there's been a lot of good work done by a lot of good people. So there have been plenty of attacks that have been stopped, and more than that, there are a lot of senior Al-Qaeda leaders that are either dead or have been captured, and the ones that are still alive spend a lot of time looking over their shoulder and devoting their energy to staying alive. So that's not inconsequential. I think another big factor is that the next attack that Al-Qaeda wants to perpetrate in the United States has got to be something that is at least equal to 9/11. I think it is not enough for them to stage an attack which is lesser in scale because it'll be perceived as weak.
Charles Hattis, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure to meet you and have you on the air with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The book, Operation Hotel California, The Clandestine War Inside Iraq, a very fascinating read by Charles Fattis. The Mark Satter Show is made possible by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. We're produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered this hour by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Stavros Halkias, and Charles Harris. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. And to hear this show again and to podcast any of our past shows and additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark. Take care.